This is Navani Thompson speaking to Peter Holmes on the Paul Sorensen Design Garden at Merriworth in the Southern Highlands. Thank you. Peter, in what year were you born?
1935.
And where?
Guildford, New South Wales.
Did you grow up there?
No. The early days were at Wallachia, out of Penrith.
Okay. Was that a sort of a rural background then?
In those days it was, yes.
What did your dad do?
He was a chef. He worked in a guest house there until the war broke out.
Okay.
And then war broke out and he moved us up to Portland where the grandparents were. And we stayed there for about 12 months and then we moved to Lura. And that's where we grew up then, was mainly in Lura.
So how old would you have been when you went to Lura?
About five. Yeah. And
was it a good place to grow up?
It was great, yes. Yeah, we loved Lura.
What was it like in those days?
Oh, in those days, well, everybody knew everybody. It's not like it is today. You walk down the street and nobody knows anybody. But in those days, as soon as you put a foot wrong, then your parents knew about it. So, it was great and good people.
It was a small town, obviously, so were you an only child?
No, I had a brother and a sister.
Young?
I was the oldest, yeah. The sister's the youngest.
The school that you went to, what was that like?
I went to the Catholic school at Katoomba, St. Canice's, and then from there up to St. Bernard's College, the De La Salle brothers, but that's closed down there, like all the Catholic schools up that area.
Really?
Yeah, there's Mount St. Mary's and St. Canice's, St. Bernard's, and then there's, I forget what they call it now, but there's another one down in the Scenic Railway. But they've all closed down.
Was your father still a chef, doing chef work up there then?
No, war broke our family up. When he came home from war, he couldn't settle down.
Yes.
So he wandered around the countryside and was brought up by my mum.
It's not an unusual story.
No. He'd come and went, but he just couldn't settle down.
Was that, how did that make you feel? Because you were sort of the man of the family in that case, didn't you?
Well, we didn't really notice it because we never knew him, because we were only, like I said, five when we went to Lura, and he was called up, and he went in the Air Force, and he'd come home on leave once, I think it was, in the war years.
How did your mum manage?
She seemed to manage all right. We all had our chores to do, so we all had to get in and help.
What sort of chores did you have to do?
Oh, mainly the wood and the coal and all that sort of stuff, just that sort of stuff in those days, but you don't see them do it today.
Did you have any particular interest in going on the land yourself when you were growing up? Was it...
Nah, not on the land. I always liked the bush because weekends we were never at home. We were always out in the bush somewhere.
And where did you go around Lura?
Oh, Minnear Falls and out to what they call the junction, and then there'd be nothing to walk, down Bridal Veil and up the Joint Stairway and home again. We used to always something different all the time. Yeah.
So you'd have got a knowledge of local plants?
Not really.
Natives? No?
No. I had no interest in gardening then. I didn't know what I was wanting to do. But gardening, getting to the gardening was a bit of a conspiracy, I think.
Explain that one.
Paul did a garden called Cherrydell, and they had access through a block of land, and their names were Becker. And they were the kids' garment, Fidel garment manufacturers, and they were Germans. So they had access through it, and like all boys in those days, we were a little bit wild. And I was working for Bill Bewley. I'd left school then, and I was working for Bill Bewley. He had a nursery in Wentworth Falls, and he wasn't in a big time, but he was big enough, but he just couldn't support because my brother had come and worked with the two of us were there then.
And what sort of period are we talking about?
1953.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And but then he couldn't support the two of us, so he said to us, if you ever found a job, you know, take it. And in those days, like I say, the ball boys were a little bit wild, and that, and being Mum the only person at home, you know, she found it a bit hard. And this Becker, Mrs. Becker, they knew old Paul, so they, she went down and had to talk to him, and that's how we come to be with old Paul. And I still think it was a conspiracy, because when we went with Paul, he more or less took my brother and myself under his wing and become a father role model for us.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, no, he was great. Hmm.
So, can you remember the first time that you met him?
Only just vaguely. He's set up at home as a funny setup. The house was just walked, and you walked in off the street up onto his veranda. And he had a table there and chairs, and we sat around, and he talked to us. And so we didn't know we had a job or not, but he said, right, we start Monday. So we didn't give Billy any notice. So we're on the Monday, that was on the Sunday, you know. So that's how it all started. I didn't know what I was going to do because before that I'd got the likings for the land before that, because when I left school I thought I'd like to do a building, become a carpenter, so I got a traineeship with a chap in Wentworth Falls, and our job was out around Glargambone and Ningen and those places building soldier settlement homes. But he went bust, and I thought I'd like to go into the Air Force and carry on the trade in there. So I filled out my application and everything, and I was just waiting on references. And in the meantime, I had to get a job. So this is how I ended up at Bewley's. There was a job going there, so I worked there for a while, and not only there for a short time, and I thought, geez, this is all right. I like this. And I didn't worry about getting my references and send my application in. And that's how I came to start on the land. But while I was out in Glargambone, I loved the country. And I thought it was great, and that's where I would have liked to have been, finish up. And here I am. Yeah.
In beautiful rural New South Wales?
Yes, yeah. Mm. Yeah, well, we started this garden. You want to go on with that now?
That's fine, yeah.
We started this garden in 1964, just when I first started to come here. I come here and did all the windbreaks, and then all these hedges, they were all overgrown and outgrown, and that's how we cut all them back to shape them up.
So the house was already built?
No, there's the house in there, in that book. Should have shown it to you earlier.
That's all right.
But,
So how exactly was the property designed then at that time?
Very, very rough.
You can't see the house.
There's a house just down through the window here.
Mm-hmm.
That was the original homestead, and that was here. Where you're sitting now, you'd be nearly sitting in the, on the end of the, on the veranda, and looking that way. And then the house was moved. They moved the house from here because this is where they wanted the homestead.
Mm-hmm.
And so they moved the house down there. They got it out in the middle of the paddock and it rained. And they were stuck out in the middle of the paddock for 6 months because they couldn't move because it was bogged. So they sat there for 6 months before they got it in this position there.
Okay.
Mm.
Okay. We'll come back to this particular garden. Let's just finish with how you first met
You don't mind me calling him old Paul.
I was going to comment on that. That's interesting that you call him old Paul. So why are you calling that?
because to us he was always old Paul. Even before we started there, it was old Paul, and the name just stuck with us. I think Brian even calls him that.
Yeah. Do you think it's possibly because he's always looked older than he is?
Well, to us, he was always old. You know, well, there used to be stories going around Lura just how old he was, but we found out later that wasn't true. He was a lot younger than what we first got to know him.
Yeah. What sort of work were you expected to do when you first joined the nursery that he had?
Just what we ended up doing, just maintenance and working on gardens.
So he had two sort of parts to the business. He had the nursery,
yes,
which would have been a retail nursery.
That's right.
And then he had the commissions for gardens.
Yes, yeah. And maintenance work also. So, like, after working with Bewley, and then we went with our Paul and my brother and myself, a bit cocky and all that, and we started to brag to him how we could graft. And he thought, oh, these young whippersnippers, they don't know what they're talking about, you know, or what it's all about. So anyway, they were building a new glass house, a big glass house, when we first started there. So we finished the glass house off, and he said to us, he's right, our boys, he says, there's the glass house, you do your grafting. He says, the nursery's there, you take whatever you want out of the nursery, put it in the glass house, and away you go. And he says, it's all up to you. So away we went, you know, we were only, my brother was 16 and I was 18 at that stage. And so we filled the glass house up with all graftable plants from around the nursery, and I don't know whether it was just a good year or what, but everything we touched grew, you know. And so he said, old Paul said to us at the time, he says, when we started grafting, he said to me, he says, right, and he says, every plant that grows, I'll give you threepence. And that was good money in them days, so, you know, so, and like I say, everything grew. And, but we didn't get our threepence. He bought us a watch each.
What did you think of that,
dude? Oh, that was great. Yeah. No, we were quite happy with that. So that gave us our legging then. That was, he knew that we knew what we were doing, and so I became his propagator, and I used to spend 3 months of the year propagating for him, grafting and all that. And, but in the meantime, National Service called my brother up, and then he went in the Nashos, and then when he came out, he couldn't settle back up to Holland, up in Katoomba again, so he moved back to Sydney. And so that's how I could become his propagator, because otherwise both of us would have propagated for him.
Yeah.
So, like I say, 3 months of the year was the time in the nursery. It was my propagating time, and then any wet days we worked in the nursery. Other times I was out maintenance. I didn't work on a lot of big gardens with him.
Did you work on Everglades at all?
Yes, I did a bit in Everglades, yeah.
Everglades is probably the best known of his works.
Yeah, yes. Well, Everglades is Paul. Yeah. No, it's... To me, walking in the Everglades is like coming here. It's just got that aura about it. It just gives you that feeling of just peace. Yeah.
So what sort of philosophy did Paul have then that you can say that you can walk into a place and say this just epitomises what he did and what he felt?
I don't see that. His philosophy to me was, be kind to your fellow man, and look after your fellow man, and that's what stuck with me through all my life. And working with him, well, he had a bit of a story about how hard he was, you know, and he was a hard boss, of course he was, but we found him great. Nothing near the stories that you heard, because he took my brother and myself under his wing, and he coaxed us on, and, you know, we used to often sit and talk for the night, and he was great.
How many other people were working with you when you were doing the propagating at the nursery?
Oh, I just did it all on my own.
Really?
Mm. Yeah, I did all these spruces and cedars and maples and all that sort of stuff.
So the exotic species that he enjoyed
too,
wasn't it?
Yes. He used to get plants from overseas, but they'd bring them into the country and they'd straight into fumigating houses, and then that was the finish of them then. Yeah, he very rarely got, if he got one to grow out of his patch, he was lucky. But the fumigation killed them all, yeah, because they had such stringent fumigating laws that, you know, he just couldn't, and there was nothing survived.
The time that you started working with him was sort of a second flush in terms of his career, and he'd I did read that with Everglades, Paul Sonson had something like 60 assistants working with him, and apparently he didn't really look at plans as such, it was all in his head, so it was very much a hands-on personal direction of what people should be doing. What was that like for, you know, to work?
Well, I didn't. It was before my time, because that was in the Depression years.
Mm-hmm.
All that went on. But when you say there's about 60 people working for him, I quite believe that, because, like, you talk to any of the old locals up there that was beyond our age, everybody you talked to, they all worked for old Paul. So you know, I think nearly all Lura worked for him at one stage, but, you know, but they did get... He was a very hard man in them days, apparently. But he mellowed when we got there. But he still had the work for you. He still expected to do your work. But no, Everglades would have been a wonderful place to work on, you know, to see it being built.
Have you done maintenance work in Everglades?
Yes, I've done work in Everglades. I did extra plantings and tree surgery and all that sort of stuff, yeah.
There was a comment that I read that it wasn't that Paul didn't like native vegetation at all. It was just that at the time when he first started in the 20s and 30s, native nurseries didn't really exist.
That's right.
So you couldn't get the stock in the first place, which is another reason for his approach of using whatever he could of the features that were already on the site, like the rocks, special trees and vistas and things, that he would incorporate those natural features.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, well, I can't say well, I ever saw a native in the nursery. It was all European plants, yeah, cold climate plants.
Mm-hmm.
But rhododendrons was the main thing up there. A beautiful show of rhododendrons and maples, yeah.
Did he specialise, you would say, in cold climate gardens then? Because that would be Blue Mountains and Southern Highlands, no?
Yeah, and Sydney. He did quite a bit through Sydney. Yeah, we worked in Bank of New South Wales, Maratta. That was up in Pimbald area, up in the North Shore. The bank, it was a T.A. Fields property. And then the bank bought it off him and turned it into a training college for managers. And we worked there. Proctors, that was in that same area. They were related to the Fields. And then old Mrs. Field, she built a new home in that area, and you'd worked on that one.
There's a lot of referral here, isn't there, between, you know, you get one job and that person refers
that's
you
right.
to someone else, and very much a personal
yes.
reference.
Yeah, well, that's how this come about.
Here at
Merriworth, yeah. Yeah, I don't know who it was that he went to saw, and I said, oh, you want to go and see Mrs. Oxley, you know, they're building down. Mrs. Oxley would like to see you, they're building down Burma, and could you go and see them? So that's how this all started.
Right.
Yeah, just through word of mouth.
There was, I believe, a thought of building a second nursery here in Berrima.
That's right, yes. Yeah, down at the rectory.
Oh,
yeah, that's... He had two boys over in England at Kew doing a horticulture course over there, and they were to come back and start off in Berrima here.
Right.
but with the war breaking out and the boys joining up to RAF over there, they didn't come home.
Oh, that was
close
to that. Yes.
Yes, it was, I think it was pretty hard on him right up to the day he died.
Mm. Did he have a large family?
Yeah, three boys. There's Ib. I worked with Ib. I didn't know Neville and Derek, though, the other two. But Ib, I worked with him all the time, yeah, whenever we were out somewhere. Yeah.
Was he like his father?
Very similar, yeah. Built like a bull. He was a big, strong sort of bloke. Yeah. And he was a good guy too, but you know, unfortunately, this cancer bit that caught up with him.
It's like family life, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, it is. Yeah.
Do you think you've learned anything from working with Sorensen so closely about what would you change your own approach to what a garden should be?
No, not really, no, because all I've ever known really is Merriworth. I haven't known much. Had a lot to do with other gardens. Whatever's in Merriworth, that's my life. That's what become my life was Merriworth.
So let's talk about Merriworth. How did you get the job in the first place?
Well, like I say, we started down here in '64.
Did he send you down here, or what?
Yes, yeah, I come down. I used to live with a manager in the old homestead, and we did the windbreaks and the hedges and all that. We started all that. That was the first job to get going, is all that.
So did Paul come down and show you what he wanted? If he didn't.
Oh yes, yeah, yes,
so
yeah.
He just told you.
Yeah, just told me. Yeah, yeah. Because you know that. Oh well, I was with him for nearly, I suppose, what, 8 years, I suppose, by then, and then we started here, yeah. And then we did all that, we got the windbreaks and all that, and we had a bit of a lull then. And I come back in '66, and then that's when life started here. And then while I was here, I used to say to the manager at the time, it was John Nicholas, and I used to say to John, you know, when the gardening job comes up, I want it. And John used to talk to Mr. Oxley about it, and Mr. Oxley was saying, no, Peter, he's Mr. Soren, old Paul's man. And so he wouldn't take me away from old Paul. Mm. So, and it's funny how things, life changes. And I just happened to be sitting down with John there one day, and I'm looking through the paper, and there's a job advertised there for a ranger. I said to John, I says, Lord, this is a good job here, I might apply for. So next thing I knew, John's come up to me, says, the garden job's yours if you want it. Because he jumped on the phone straight away and he said to Mr. Oakley, Peter's thinking about changing jobs. So that's how it all come about. It was, you know, it might have been a bit of conspiracy there too.
A bit of fate too.
So that's how all that came about. And then old Paul knew long before I gave him a notice that I was coming here, because Mr. Oxley had written to old Paul and said he's sorry to hear that I was going to leave and come down here to work. And there's a letter somewhere around here, Mr. Oxley still has it, you know, that old Paul had wrote back to him and saying he couldn't be more pleased to see Peter going into one of his gardens to work, to look after it.
Wonderfully generous thing to say too. That must have pleased.
Well, that was in the letter, but that's not how it worked out in the end. Yeah.
So it was not a happy parting.
Not really, no. But we still kept in touch. If he was ever in the area, he always called in, and we always wandered around, had a bit of a talk, and say, you should do this or you should do that, you know, this needs doing or that needs doing, you know. Mm. And, he still kept his hand on it. And then he had his accident, and then we didn't see him after that. He didn't come back down here again. Mm. Yeah. I used to bring maples down for me to graft down here, you know, and load up his truck and bring them down.
So you never really stopped working for him?
No, that only happened a couple of times. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Well, it must have been a loss to him, but also, as he said, in a satisfaction in the sense that if you're going anywhere, the fact that you will be maintaining a garden that he designed, and that link was obviously important to him.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, but anybody that worked for old Paul always ended up doing well, because he just taught you how to work, what work was about, and that's how, you know, that's how it was, you know, because I always remember once there, even myself were doing a job we'd putting paths in the bush house, and it was coming up near dark and that, and we're doing levelling and that, and we doing the formwork for these paths, and I put the Ipsit to him. He says, how is it? Is it level? And I put the level on it, and I said, oh, I says, near enough's good enough. I couldn't really see it. And the next thing, I got grabbed by the ears. I was lifted up on my feet, and it was old Paul. And he says, near enough's not good enough. I want it good enough. And that stuck with me all through my life. So anything I do now, it's got to be done right. Yeah.
Sorry, I was going to say, it sounds as though he didn't demand more of other people than he did of himself in terms of work and work ethic.
No. The only thing was that when we were ever moving trees, we always, whoever it was, either Brian or myself, we always tried to get the opposite corner to old Paul. Because you didn't only have to lift the tree, you had to lift him as well. Because, like in those days, there was no backhoes or anything like that to lift. It was all done manually on hessian bags and all this sort of stuff. So, you know, you'd all have there'd be four of us, and we'd all have a corner, and you're just about ready to lift, and then this hand would come and plonk on your shoulder. It was old Paul. He'd take his purchase off you. So... So there's always, whenever there was a tree to be lifted, somebody always, Brian and myself, we'd be trying to grab the other corner.
So you wouldn't have a heavy hand at all.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we didn't want to be either side of him. Yeah. No, he, even though as he was getting on in years, he could still, he was a very strong man. Yeah. Very, very strong. No, like I say, he was the one that taught, if you worked for him, you knew how to work. If there's a mountain to be moved, he'd give you a pick and shovel and a wheelbarrow and say, away you go, move it. And that's what you did, because we moved a lot of soil around that nursery just with wheelbarrows. Yeah. Mm. There's none of this backhoe business, no.
What about this property here? How large is this garden?
Oh, I suppose the garden's about 5 acres, counting the driveway. Well, if you want to, just to show you the type of person he was, if you did the right thing by him, then he'd look after you. He treated everybody equal. Everybody was treated equal. And after I got married, then there's a house come up for sale at the back of the nursery. And he said to me, he says, you want to buy that place, because it was great. There was a big block of land went with it and all that. So I applied to the bank, and the bank said, no, you've got no security. So old Paul said to me, he says, right, he says, I'll go up and talk to this bank manager. So up he went, and the bank manager said, no, he's got no security, we can't give him a loan. So old Paul said, right, he says, if you don't give him a loan, he says, I'll change my bank. So I don't know whether he did or not, but old Paul financed us on our house. And he not only us, he did it with Brian. So, you know, that's the type of person he was. I suppose because he had your pay packet before you got it. And your rent was gone, or your payment was gone before you got your pay. But if you're ever in any trouble, you know, financial wise, that he was the first person to come to the fore and help you out. Yeah. No, no, that's one thing I can always look up to him for what he did for us. Yeah.
That's a life-changing decision, isn't it? That to support you at a time like that.
Mm.
I mean, who knows what you might have done if you'd not been settled and happy in that.
That's right. Yeah.
Property right there.
Yeah. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, no, he was good like that.
Okay.
Mm.
Merryworth, when does the garden look its best?
In October. Yeah. We've just come out of the winter, the stark period, as I call it, and then the avenue, oh, it's magnificent up there.
Describe the avenue for me.
Oh, the avenue mainly is elms, golden elms, cherries, white cherries and their fuges, and golden ash in the background. And then it's flanked on the western side by torulosis. There's the windbreak. But there's only one thing that goes against it all. The trees up there should be twice the size that they are now, because it's not topsoil. It sits on a bauxite band, and the trees just don't like, won't go into the bauxite. So they sit stunted. Oh, I call them stunted, but like I say, they should be twice the size as they are. But there's just very hard conditions up there, that's all. Mm. But coming into spring, the soft foliage of the elms and the white flowers of the cherries, and the very soft foliage on the elm, on the ash, is it's just a picture. And the green, just with the lawn starting to really come into its own, and it's the place where I want to end up.
Have you chosen your elm yet?
No, I just want to be spread out all the way. Yeah,
mulched down.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, fertilised. Yeah. Now that's where I'd like to finish up.
So is that your favourite part of the garden?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the top spot.
I was quite intrigued by the little island in the swimming pool.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that had a cedar, I think it was, at one time.
Yes.
It's really quite a feature.
Yes, it started off with a native in there. Actually, it was the plant was here when the pool was designed, and I don't know what the plant's name was, because I was never into natives, and it had a blue flower on it, and that's how the island came to be there, because Mrs. Oxley didn't want this plant out, so that's how it stayed there until over the years it died, and then we planted a golden cedar.
Was that Paul's suggestion?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, this cedar would be in those days, to grow anything big was grown in dunny cans. And there's a part of the nursery there that used to get a bit windblown. And this cedar got blown over in the wind there many years before, and the cedar grew as a bonsai. And that's what it looked like, as a bonsai shape. And that's what it was planted with. And then with ground covers, conifer ground covers, and with this cedar. And then after it came out of the dunny can and into that, and it decided it was going to straighten up. So it straightened up and up it went. And it was huge in the end. So it just got too big. There's some pruning done while I was away on holidays once, and when I come back, the thing was cut in half. So it just didn't suit. And so it had to come out. And then there's an Inensis, crabapple Inensis in there now. But I think that's, life is short too, I think, by the looks of it. Yeah, it's starting to die back.
So what will you replace it with?
Don't know yet.
So now you've got those decisions that you make yourself about what replaces what?
Yes, yeah. Oh, Mr. Oxley's daughter, Amber, I confer with her a lot of times. when I come back after my break, I virtually had the run of the place and did what I wanted to do and spoke to Mr. Oxley about rhododendrons, because Mrs. Oxley loved rhododendrons, and the rhododendron bed, we planted it up 3 times before, and this is the 4th time. I should have known my better judgment about going ahead with it, with rhododendrons again, because we just had no luck with them. And
is it the soil again, or
what? Oh, it comes down to a fungal problem, and I just can't see, because I've never sprayed rhododendrons in my life, but that's all I seem to do. That's in the last planting, because we never ever were able to work out what the problem was. We thought it was the scrotus from out of the plants that are above it. It gets covered in grubs, and then that's, the time is just like rain, it is, and this sappy stuff. Yeah. And that's what I was putting it down to, and I think Mr. Oxley thinks the same way as well. Because I was only speaking to him the other day about it, because I want to go ahead and change the whole setup now, because the rhododendron we planted 2 years ago, I've had it. And just gradually dig them out one by one. And so the bed's become vacant again.
And what are your thoughts on replacing?
I've got to talk to the nurseryman about that, just to see what's available, because I was out of the garden for 12 years, I think it was, because I started here in 68. That's when I moved down here. We moved family down in 68. And then I worked for about 12 years in the garden, and then I just started to get a hemmed-in feeling. I needed to spread my wings a bit. And then John Nicholas was still managing at that time, and then he left. And then when he left, they decided that I'd take on the manager's job, because I'd learned enough from John to do stock work and all that, and then it was just a matter of looking after the property. So the 1,500 acres become the garden. That's the way I looked at it. And then we employed several gardeners over the period of time to look after it. But I don't know, they just didn't look after it the way I looked after it. And then I got crook and had to leave, and then the greatest thrill that I ever got was getting a phone call from Mr. Oxley to ask me if I had any spare time to come up and fix his irrigation system, because the irrigation system in the garden, I'm the only one who knows anything about it now, because all the rest have all passed on or they moved out of the area.
And you're not telling anyone else, presumably.
Oh, no, no, Ken's the new manager, he's learning. I've got to show somebody. I won't be around forever and a day, but no, Ken's good. Yeah, he's learning well, yeah.
And was the system put in the 60s then?
That was put in by Deverson and Jan. They come and worked out of Cabramatta. Old Sid Deverson, he lives out at out towards Robbo. Burrowing. Yes, that's right. He's still alive. He's still got all the old parts and all that for the system, but we're changing all that, going more plastic and instead of the brass fittings and all that. Yeah. Yes, so that's how it come about.
And have you worked 3 days a week here ever since?
Well, you say 2 days.
2 days.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, after I got the system going, and then Mr. Oxley said to me, he says, what do you think of the garden? I says, it needs a bit, a lot of TLC. And he said, have you got any spare time? And I said, oh, I can make spare time. Because at that stage, we'd moved down to Ulla Dulla, and I was only sitting around vegetating, and it was no good. I needed to do something, and then this was the greatest thrill and honour that I could have had, was to get asked back here again and to come back and to look after it again, yeah, in the garden. It was really a thrill, yeah. And I just can't appreciate it more than what I do now.
I was thinking that it can't be inexpensive to maintain staff and somebody skilled as you are 2 days a week to maintain a garden this size. So what do you think, why do you think Mr. Oxley and others so value this garden just 70 years on?
Why do they value it? Oh, I suppose comes down to it's their style of garden, being English as they are, and that's what the garden is. It's an English garden, and I suppose that's why they value it so much in being old Paul's too. And, I don't know whether the younger generation feels the same way about it, but no, it's...
It sits very happily in this environment, doesn't it?
It does, yes. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Have you been to Invergowrie and Redlands, the other Sorenson design gardens here?
I went, in the early days with old Paul, I went to Invergowrie to do a pruning job. And old Paul said to me, he says, what do you like in climbing trees? And I said, oh, I says, great. I says, no problem at all. Because in those days, as kids, you'd be climbing through trees all over the place. And he said, right, he says, we've got a job down at Invergowrie, down at Exeter. And I thought, where in the blazes is Exeter, And so anyway, early one morning, off we head. And there's Zib and myself and old Paul. And we get down to Invergowrie, and geez, where are we? I had no idea where we were. But a beautiful garden. Oh, I loved it, yeah. So anyway, we had this big elm to prune. And up I go up the tree, and all I could do was wrap my legs and my arms around it and hang on. And old Paul could see I wasn't at all happy up there, so down I come, and do you think I could stop my knees from knocking together? No.
How tall was it?
Oh, it was massive. And what we did was we run a line from the centre point up the top to a certain area outside from the trunk, and everything outside of that area was cut off. So there was limbs coming off anything up to 15 inches in thickness. It was big. Yeah. So that was my taste of tree pruning. I wasn't as good as what I thought I was. Yeah. Because like in those days, there's no harnesses, no nothing. It was all done just climbing like monkeys.
Do you recall any similarities between the two gardens?
Oh, yes, yeah.
In what way?
Oh, just the way it's set out and the style of trees and the type of trees and the way it was set up, yeah. Yes, it reminded me a lot of... Everglades in a lot of ways, but only this was on flat ground. I never ever got down into the Dell, but they tell me the Dell is a wonderful spot to go and have a look at. I never ever got down into there.
You've got that to look forward to, perhaps?
Yes, I suppose, if I never get out there. Yeah.
Now, we talked earlier about the fact that Paul liked to... He had favourites in terms of species, and can you name some of the trees that he's used here, which are perhaps common to his other major gardens?
Oh, mainly the maples, the cherries, elms, ash.
There seem to be firs or pines here too, for a contrast.
Well, we never planted... Oh, the only pines we planted was on the windbreak. We used the torulosis for the outside break to stop the wind first off, and then in the earlier days there was three rows planted. There was the torulosis and then two rows of pines, the Patchula and Montezuma. But I think in old Paul's mind eye that they were to come out earlier than, well, they're still there, but they're lanky trunks, just trunks. It's nice to walk through the trunks now because I've cleaned them all up and lifted them up. So they're just trunks, there's no limbs or anything. But what it's done is it's killed the eastern side of the torulosis. There's no greenery on the eastern side. It's all been smothered out. And so now we do get a bit of wind through because there's only that small bit of foliage on the outside, on the western side. So those are the only conifers that were planted, except I did the windbreak on the eastern, on the southern side with... the name just escapes at the moment. But that was to stop the southerly winds from coming through because the pines that we had there, they died and we needed something. So then I expanded the garden further out, planted these before the others had finished their time. And so as they were coming up in the meantime, and then there we got that break now. And but they were the only conifers that were planted. A lot of the others were here, the cedars, the deodars, and all that. But they were all original. And
how long do you think they've been here?
When you look in the book there, you'll see them in there. They're about probably 8 foot high. So that's, you could say they're about 5 year old, 5-6 year old. Mm. Yeah.
What are some of the features of the garden? I think there's a ha-ha. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, Paul used to call it the hoo-ha. And that's what we're always known it as, the hoo-ha wall.
Is it the fuss it took to make?
No, there's no fuss, no. It's just the way old Paul spoke, hoo-ha, you know. Yeah. Yeah, because if you're ever driving anywhere and then you ho ho ho, you know, and you think, oh, what's going on? He's found something. And then there'd be a patch of thistles over in the paddock. So he'd be out over the fence with his knife. Out comes the knife and he'd cut himself some thistle heads. This is the milk thistles. And then they would go home and into his soup. That'd be some of his soup of the night, yeah, because he used to often say to him, he says, you never see the cow with a flu, do you? But I don't know, somebody tells me the cows don't eat thistles. but that's where it used to end up, you know. Yeah, be driving along and ho ho ho. And I think that's how he talked about the hoo-ha wall. It was the hoo-ha. Yeah. But that's what really makes this garden. That's the view, is looking down over that, across onto the dams on the other side. There's only the one dam originally, and then later on, then they built the bigger dam, and which covers seven and a half acres, and that is the view now. It's looking down through there. The only thing that blocks all that is the Irish elms. They were planted just as a stopgap, and with the pyramid birch. Beyond that, around the top of the hoo-ha, and they would act. Old Paul's view was, sight was, that they were the birch would act as window frames. So as you looked around, you had a different setting, and the elms were only there as a stopgap, and they were to come out. But Mr. Oxley couldn't ever come to get rid of them, so they're still there, and we try to keep them lifted so as we can get the view underneath them, but they just keep on going up and up and up. And we started off originally by taking the top out of them, but the view is actually under them, not over them, yeah, because you can't get high enough to see over them now. So we start taking them up. Yeah. But no, the hoo-ha was built out of brick. It was only the one wall put in originally, and then just made the slope from the main house down to the top of the wall too severe. So there was another wall put in to break that level. So as we have a walking level around the top of the hoo-ha, which, and then the other level where the lawn runs down onto it.
We've talked briefly about the swimming pool as well.
Mm.
What else have you got? You've got a cherry, do you have a cherry walk or something?
Oh, the cherry walk was down the road of rhododendron bed. Some cherries come up from seeding. Somebody spat a few seeds out, and these seedlings come up, and so I thought, oh, well, these would be worth hanging on to, so I hung on to them and budded them when they got high enough, and then we planted them along the path leading down to the rose bed, and which is on the east southern side is the rhododendron bed, and we use the cherries as the cover. But over the years, with bird problems and fungal problems, and they're slowly dying out. Birds, the parrots are our biggest problem as far as the cherries are concerned now, because they go along and eat all the buds, the flowering buds off them through the winter months, and come the spring, and then you only get a few clumps of clusters of flowers on them, and it's sadly worth having them, and they're slowly over this, with this going on, it's knocking, killing the trees. Yeah, but there's just one thing we can't stop is the parrots, because we like the natives, we don't want to get rid of them. But that was our cherry walk, yeah.
Are there other features like that?
No, not really. The rose garden is the feature at the end of that, of the rhododendron walk, or what used to be the rhododendron. Mrs. Oxley loved the roses. The Oxleys would come up on Friday nights, and first thing Saturday morning, Mrs. Oxley, she'd be out in the rose garden cutting roses, and then the main house looked like a rose garden when she finished with it. And then the Sunday night, they all had to be packed up and taken back to Sydney. So they were used in both homes. Yeah.
We were just talking about Mrs. Oxley. What was her Christian name?
Amber.
And how she would come down from the city and get up really early on the Saturday to go down to her rose garden.
That's right.
Can you recall some of the species that are there that would give her particular pleasure?
No. Geez, after all these years, it's hard to remember. The only one I remember down there was the polo, because Mrs. Oxley loved white.
So did she have a lot of white species then?
No. There was only the one bed that we had at polos, and then there was just a range of colours. But the camellia hedge that we have here, that's all white. And the cherries. But anything that was white, she loved, yeah.
Did she have any input really into the choice of the larger shrubs, or was that all Paul's?
I think it was between Paul and her, yes. Yeah, I think that was... I never come into the conversations with that. But I only did as I was told, yeah.
You only did all the work.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Yeah. But I couldn't really say on that, to be honest. Yeah.
You get the sense that Paul was very precise about the species and the location for trees and shrubs, but that the smaller things were really left up to the personal preference of the owner, that he didn't really mind so much about the smaller infill things.
When we first did the garden, the courtyards, Mrs. Sorensen, she had her part of the nursery was ground covers.
Really?
And she had a terrific collection of ground covers, and that's what we planted the courtyards up with, was all ground covers originally, and that's where the orchard was the courtyards. When I first come here, all the fruit trees were in an orchard at the back of the garden, and that was the first job after he did the windbreaks, and that was to move all the fruit trees out of the orchard and into the courtyards. The house wasn't built then. I had a surveyor's map plan, and with all levels and all this, and this was my job, was to move all the fruit trees in, and they were all planted before the house was built. The fruit trees were all planted, they were all wrapped up in straw, they looked like scarecrows, and that's what it was. The courtyard was just fruit trees, and then all ground covers underneath from the nursery up in Lura. We planted a large selection of them, and just with what survived was what survived. Mm. And the only thing that ever survived out of it was the vinca. That's the only thing that's still original. All the other ground covers, no, they just couldn't take it. It was too hot in there for them. Mm. It gets terribly hot through the summer months, because you get no breeze or anything in the courtyards.
How many courtyards are there?
Well, we have it in three sections. That's what I call the courtyards. Yeah, yeah. Mm.
And the paving that sort of links them, you can go through one to the...
Oh, it's only the driveway as you come under the carport and finish at the front door here. You know, that's what I call the courtyard anyway, because it's the only way I can describe it. It's courtyards, and that's just this. Out of the original fruit trees there, all that's left now is the pear and two apples. Out of I forget how many trees were there originally, but it would have been nine. There would have been about 12 fruit trees in there. Mm. But
are they hard to move? I mean, are they
not
mature or
not really? No, once you know how to do them, and there's no problem at all. It's just a matter of stop the transpiration of them while, you know, after you moved them, if you can stop that, then that's why they were wrapped up in straw. Mm. And they were straw from ground to tip, and you know, just all wrapped up. Yeah.
You talked about doing things when you first started which were really hands-on and labour-intensive. So how does the perhaps new equipment that gardeners have available to them, how's that help you?
Well, in the garden here, it doesn't help me at all because it's just too confined now. You can't get that sort of machinery in. But it's all still done by hand. And like when we replanted the rhododendrons, all that bed was retrenched again, and that was something that old Paul was always good at doing, was trenching. And That's a big job to do. But it's a job that if it's got to be done, it's got to be done. Yeah, so we retrenched it all, thinking that, we're right this time, we'll get the rhododendrons to grow, but still a fungal problem.
So would you consider placing them elsewhere and having another go in another part of the garden?
No, not here. No, no.
It's actually the whole lie of the land that you think is a problem for them.
Yes, yes, yeah. I don't know about this area for them, really, because originally, when we originally did it, it was on the original soil. And we had problems. We moved all these rhododendrons down from the nursery, and they were come down in a Pentec truck, covered in, I thought they were big trees, and slowly they just died from the tip back, and
must have been very frustrating for you.
It was, yes, and so Cecil Hoskins was out near Mount Broughton, and he had rhododendrons growing out there, so I went out, and I think his gardener, his name was Jack at that time, and so I went out to see Jack. And he had his in all built-up beds with bush sand. And they were all with in a bush house set up, all undercover. So we tried to apply this, not with the bush house, though, but by building our bed up with bush sand and growing them in that, but we still had the same problems. The problems still come back, this fungal problem. But they had problems growing them over there too, but they did get them to grow. I suppose a bit of protection overhead with the bush house, shade house, and that, yeah.
Have you tried anything else that you have actually had to give up on that was part of perhaps the original design?
No. What was everything here is still original except for the fruit trees. We've moved the... I've just planted up another orchard. That's down in the veg garden. We've got an area down near the dam there which we use as a vegetable garden and that. And that's another part of my job is to... grow vegetables for the property. So.
Does the property still run stock?
Oh, yes. Yeah, about 1,200 ewes, and I think they've got about 40 head of cattle, I think it is.
Mm.
Yeah, it's mainly fat lambs, that's what turns on, comes off. But I'd love to be in it now with the price of lambs they are getting today. Yeah. If we got $24, we thought we were doing well. But now, $124. It would have made life a lot easier. Yeah.
I suppose they have their ups and downs too,
isn't it? Yes, it's like everything in agriculture, you know. Wool's good 1 year. Lambs are down. Lambs go up, wool goes down, you know. That's the way it goes.
Are you pleased that you stuck to gardening rather than farming?
No, I enjoyed all what I've done. It's all been a challenge, I suppose you could say. But like I said, the garden become too confined for me, and by moving out and taking on the manager's job, and then that. Really opened up my horizons and gave me a lot to do and more work to do. But after working for Old Paul, work was what it was all about. Yeah. Yeah, so. No, they were good years. I enjoyed it. But in the end, it just got the better of me. That's why I had to give it away.
Where do you see the garden going from now? Just gradually, there had to be compromises made. Along the line. We're talking now about the rhododendrons, which was perhaps an interest of Mrs. Oxley more than Paul. So, say in the next 10 or 20 years, how do you see the garden growing?
There's some species will survive. But it's like I mentioned before about the cherries. The cherries are, I think they'll be on their way out. The alums and the ash. This and the oaks, they'll all survive, but I think there's a limited time on the cherries, I think. Their years are getting numbered now.
Mm. Will you replant?
I think you'd find it a battle to get it to grow. Because you can't rip the soil anymore because of the irrigation system and the roots of the other trees and that. And that's what the place, not the place needs, but if you're doing anything like that, you need to rip it so that you can get the roots down and for them to get a hold and get going. But unfortunately, you know, if you want to have a look, you'll see what I mean later and that's what it's, you know, that's the sad part about it. But they're the ones that I feel that will be lost. Mainly the cherries, yeah.
And do you think there'll still be the interest in, say, 20 years' time in maintaining a specifically Sorensen-designed garden?
I don't think the design will change. But then who knows what's going to happen in 20 years, you know. Hopefully the Oxleys will still have it. But who knows? Nobody can foresee that far forward.
Thank you, Peter.
Just to summarise the whole interview, they say things come in threes. Well, are we on air again?
Yes, we're on air again.
Yeah, well, things come in threes. I was fortunate enough to start my life with old Paul, who took on the fatherly aspect for me, my marriage to Rosemary. She was a great mother. Well, she brought up four kids. We had four kids, Jeff, Lisa, Kim and Mark. If it wasn't her, then she was the one who did the upbringing of the kids, because with old Paul we worked away so much that I never was with my family much. That's part of the reason why I come to Berrima, because I knew that if I could get the gardening job, and then we could be all together. Because my young bloke, he never knew me. When I used to go home at night, we'd leave early in the morning to go to work in Sydney, or I'd be down here. Then when I'd go home, and if I went near him, he'd scream. So you know, it wasn't much of a life working like that. And then working down here, when we did the garden here, when I wasn't in the nursery grafting, I was down here, and then that went on for 2.5 years. And so it was up to Rosemary that she did the upbringing of the kids, and because my time was involved in my work. That was the second thing in life, and the third thing that came about in life was me coming to Merriworth. And Merriworth has been my life ever since. That was 34 years ago. And it was the best thing that could have ever happened to me. I just don't know how to put this.
Didn't come.
I'd just like to thank the Oxleys for giving me the privilege of working down here for them. She was a wonderful woman, and he was a great boss. You couldn't wish for anybody better. And to work for them, and in the surroundings as it is, you couldn't want better. So, thank you.
Thank you.